Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the lesser-known accomplishments of the Nixon administration was reversing of almost 200 years of paternalism and interference by the federal government into the affairs of Native American tribes. Now, prior to this change, the federal government was actually on a course towards ending the special, if flawed, relationship between tribes and the U.S. government. But with this reversal, of course, it gave way to a new era of tribes being able to self-determine their future and control the lands granted to them through treaty. The National Archives, Gilcrease Museum, and the Nixon Foundation are joining forces to co-present a conference on the idea of Native American self-determination from the Nixon presidency to the present time. The conference will take place this Wednesday at Gilcrease Museum from 10:30 to 3, and the event is free and open to the public. During the conference, you'll hear from former department officials in the Justice Department, the White House staff, the Department of Interior, including my guest today, Reed Peyton Chambers, who from 1973 to 1976 was the Associate Solicitor for Indian Affairs at the U.S. Department of the Interior. For many years, he has been in private practice, specializing in Indian law, representing Indian tribes all over the country, everything from land claims to water rights, hunting and fishing rights, reservation boundary issues in Alaska, tribal rights and immunities. He'll be moderating two panels, one looking at the Nixon administration decision and the impact of that decision over the following years. Again, the conference takes place Wednesday at Gilcrease Museum, and it is free and open to the public. Reed Chambers joins me from his office in Washington, D.C. Reed Chambers, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
This forum will be at Gilcrease this week. We'll be looking at the major change that happened during the Nixon administration regarding how the government related to Native American peoples. This was a major change. Before we talk about what the Nixon administration did at that particular time that has literally transformed American Indian tribes, talk about where we were prior to the change in policy. At this particular point, government was pretty antagonistic to Indian tribes, and they were wanting to sort of finish the assimilation process by basically no longer dealing with tribal governments.
Yes, that's absolutely right, Rich, that the policy from the end of the Second World War, really up to 1970, the dominant federal policy had been to terminate all relations with Indian tribes and to essentially forcibly assimilate them into the American melting pot and have no further responsibility for them. It was called the termination policy. And that was the policy really began in the Truman administration, and it continued in the Eisenhower administration, and of course, Nixon was Eisenhower's vice president, so tribes were apprehensive when Nixon got the nomination and when it looked like he would be president, because tribes had bitterly resisted terminating the treaties and terminating the special federal relationship with them.
Was it the goal of basically just an end of Indian land, of all rights of the tribes at that particular, was that the basic end game at that point under termination?
Well, certainly it was, I mean, there were forces that were trying to seize Indian lands. But it was also, and this is funny to say, but it was also inspired by a certain idealistic impulse. The idea that Indians should be treated like everyone else, that they shouldn't have any special rights, but they shouldn't be discriminated against either, that they should be free of what had been a fairly oppressive federal bureaucracy in dealing with Indians, that the Bureau of Indian Affairs, until Nixon's time, really, was largely non-Indian bureaucrats, sometimes well-intentioned, but a kind of a paternalistic and oppressive control of Indians, that they couldn't do things without approval of these non-Indian bureaucrats. And one of the big changes Nixon made was to not just simply reject termination as a policy, but to reject the practice of federal paternalistic control of Indians and really let Indians run their own affairs on their reservations.
You know, that paternalistic policy sort of justified things which went against Indian people's wishes. at the same time, it was, we always know what's better for you.
Yes, it was. Indian reservations were in a lot of ways administered, it was sort of like a domestic colony. I mean, you know, just like the British Empire over India or over Nigeria or the African countries. It was really the idea of the white man's burden and the white man knows best. And of course, there's always abuses of power anytime anyone tries to govern anyone else. It's hard to believe it now, Rich, but in 1970, Indians were one of the very few constituent groups in American society that weren't really fully allowed to govern themselves. I mean, this was the period, you know, when African Americans were really sometimes for the first time in some of the southern states being allowed to vote and participate in governing their own affairs. And so Indians weren't entirely unique in American history. Women actually couldn't vote, as you know, until the 1920s. But the Nixon policy, really, the basic policy that he proclaimed was that Indian communities should rule the affairs, the Indians should make those decisions, and no one else should. And that was a, now it seems like it's obvious and clearly right, and it was clearly right. But in terms of what went before, it was a dramatic and remarkable change.
Well, it was a dramatic break with the prior policy. Where did this come from? Did it come from Nixon himself? Did it come from advisors advising Nixon? As I understand, there was a speech in September of 1968 where I believe he sort of outlined some of his ideas, right?
I think it was a letter. But this is a very good question, and I want to tell your listeners, this is one of the things that our panel on Wednesday will be exploring, that the policy was basically embodied in a message to Congress that President Nixon authored and sent in 1970. And one of our panelists, Bobby Kilberg, was involved in actually writing the policy under the direction of Nixon and senior White House staff. So one of the questions that the panel on Wednesday morning at the Gilchrist Museum will be examining is, how did the policy originate? Now, you're certainly right that in 1968, during the campaign, Nixon wrote a letter to the National Congress of American Indians and stated that he would not support the termination policy, and that no Indian tribe would be terminated in the Nixon administration.
And that was a real fear of Indians, because the last time when termination gathered steam was during the Eisenhower administration, when Nixon had been vice president, right?
That's absolutely right. And it really was a major relief to tribes that Nixon made that statement, and it was warmly received. You know, policies, I think during the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, termination was no longer an announced goal of the federal government, but there were members of Congress who did seek to terminate tribes and get legislation through in that time. And there were also people in the federal bureaucracy, major staff people on congressional committees, who had cut their teeth on Indian policy during the termination era. That was certainly true of the Bureau of the Budget, or now the Office of Management and Budget, had senior staffers who thought, gee, we could save a lot of money if we could get the federal government out of the Indian business. So some of the terminationist ideas had burrowed their way inside the governmental structures, and it really wasn't until the Nixon presidency that the government really freed itself from that.
And how sweeping was the change? How big a change? I mean, first of all, it's empowering tribal governments in some places where tribal governments were really not very powerful or really existent. I know some tribes where the tribal government wasn't that sort of recognized or pronounced, I guess.
Actually, a change had begun in the 1960s, and this is before I got involved in Indian affairs. I really became the chief lawyer at the Interior Department in 1973 under President Nixon. But the change actually had begun a decade earlier, and I think it began with the Office of Economic Opportunity, the poverty program, in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. When the Office of Economic Opportunity began to make grants and send federal monies directly to Indian tribes as part of its policy of empowering grassroots, underprivileged people generally. And so they didn't deal with the states. They didn't deal with the local governments. They didn't deal with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. They dealt directly with tribes. And so for the first time, the tribes had a source of income and a source of operating programs that wasn't dependent on the, you know, essentially the white paternalistic Bureau of Indian Affairs, and was something that came directly to them. And tribal governments really did begin to develop and flourish in that period. And of course, this was also the time when veterans of the Second World War were the generation that was largely dominant in running Indian tribal governments, and that was a pretty self-sufficient group of people, and armed with kind of the federal programs that were going on in the more in the Johnson administration, I think, than in the Kennedy administration. This is something that began. So I think some of the push for the Nixon message came from tribal leaders themselves and from the practice of tribal leaders taking more control over their own affairs in the 1960s.
My guest today is Reed Chambers, who was the former associate solicitor for the U.S. Department of Interior. Basically, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was his client in that post. He served in the Nixon administration and the end of the Ford administration as well. He's now in private practice in Washington, D.C., primarily representing Indian tribes, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He'll be one of the speakers at a forum looking at the treatment of Native American peoples during the Nixon era, which really changed the relationship between tribes and the federal government. And Mr. Chambers, if you would, give us a sense of tribal governance, how their rights changed as a result of this change in policy.
Rich, there were two important changes to mention in that regard. The first one is that President Nixon's message, the 1970 message to Congress, stated that rather than terminating the federal trust responsibility and relationship with Indian tribes, the government should vigorously enforce its trust relationship and its trust responsibility. And it should act as a trustee for Indian tribes in supporting their rights. And that meant that, say, with Indian water rights or Indian hunting and fishing rights or just rights to self-government, that the federal government should promote cases where they brought suits against tribes and private interests that were impinging on Indian rights. So a lot of my job, I had the support of the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, the late Morris Thompson, and that was very helpful. But a lot of my job was dealing directly with tribes and in bringing claims to water rights or supporting claims to hunting and fishing rights for tribes, or in some cases, supporting claims that tribes had the lands that had been taken unlawfully from them. And the government during the Nixon period, and I think this is something that's continued for most of the last 40 years, became actively involved as a trustee in protecting the rights of the Indian trust beneficiaries. So that was one important change. There'd been some times when the government had done that before, but it became a conscious policy under President Nixon, and it was continued by his successors, both Democrats and Republicans.
Let's talk about land rights for a moment, because when we think of, you know, Indian land rights, we think of the continual number of agreements for most of these tribes as they were pushed west, as they were assigned lands. But I think for the most part here in the West, we think that once those boundaries were established, say, around the turn of the 20th century, that they were pretty much left alone. But from what I'm understanding, what you're saying, that there was still encroachment on reservations or traditional tribal lands that had been granted to these tribes after the 48 states were pretty much settled.
That's right. I'm thinking of, for example, in Oklahoma, one of the controversies that came up and was ultimately decided by the Supreme Court during the Nixon administration was the claims of the tribes to the Arkansas riverbed. Mm-hmm. That was an important Supreme Court case. It was a little bit before I became associate solicitor, so it wasn't something that I was involved in. But one thing that we began to do, I don't know whether the government did it in that case, but we began to, where tribes had suits against, let's say, the state of Oklahoma, was the defendant in the riverbed case, we began to adopt a policy where the federal government would file friend of the court briefs in favor of tribes and in favor of their land claims. It came up a lot while I was in office, began to come up in the eastern states. Mm-hmm. Your listeners may remember, those who are old enough to remember it, tribes in Maine had a land claim to a good portion of Maine, where they felt that their land rights had never been lost by any kind of federal treaty. And there is a statute, goes back to the first Congress, that says the only way Indians can lose lands is pursuant to a congressional treaty or a congressional enactment. Otherwise, the lands aren't lost. Now, what had happened is the state of Maine had sort of seized Indian lands and made agreements with the tribes up in that state, but they'd never been ratified by Congress. And so during my term of office, we had to consider whether to support those claims or not. And ultimately, the government did decide to support them. So the government participated in lawsuits on behalf of the Maine Indian tribes, the major tribes up there. There were three tribes. And the suits were ultimately settled in a congressional enactment during the Carter administration. But there are a lot of situations throughout the lower 48. One's not coming immediately to mind other than the Arkansas River.
Well, I was going to say, maybe the Taos Indians in Blue Lake.
Well, that's a very good example. Yeah. That in New Mexico.
This was the lake that was just taken from the Taos Indians. They'd always considered it their property or their land.
That's right, and it had been seized actually by the Forest Service. I think it was during President Teddy Roosevelt's time, and part of the Nixon message was to return Blue Lake to the Taos Indians, and there was some opposition, as I understand it. Again, this is something that Bobby Kilberg will talk about on our panel because she was involved in it, but one of the important proposals in the Nixon message was returning Blue Lake to the Taos Pueblo.
And you saw that in numerous cases after this happened. Now, certain properties and certain lands have still been contested. I think of the Black Hills and the Lakota. That's still being adjudicated now here, 50 years since this, and probably, 100 years, over 100 years since the original dispute. But you did see a lot of lands returning to tribes, water rights. The Colorado River Compact all of a sudden has to take into account tribes who had treaty water rights.
That's right, and those are still being adjudicated. But we began that process. And in fact, there had been a lawsuit even before the 1970s involving the rights of some tribes to the Colorado River. And what states have found is that, I would say, I'm thinking now for Arizona, for example, that the government built a project, a federal project, bringing Colorado River water into central Arizona. It's called the Central Arizona Project. That was beginning to be constructed when I was in office, and the question became, how much water should the Indians get out of that project? Well, as it turns out, a little less than half of the water from the Central Arizona Project is actually being supplied to Indian tribes mostly in the central part of the state, sometimes in other parts of the state. Because just like the Indians were here first and had some land rights that weren't always observed, that the law was pretty clear even in the 1970s that when treaties were made with tribes, the treaties impliedly reserved sufficient water for the Indians so they could, whatever water they needed to establish a viable, self-sufficient economy on those lands. But in most states, the states more or less appropriated the water for non-Indian uses, and that's something that has been changed over the last 30 or 40 years as tribes have asserted their water rights, usually with the government supporting them.
Yeah, of course, as you well know, this is still an issue. And I think for non-Native peoples, it's a hard thing to get our head around because these rights were not observed, that, you know, the rights are still reserved.
Well, that's right. The normal law in Western states, and I think this is the law for everybody but Indians in Oklahoma, is that you get a water right if you put it to use. And, you don't have a water right if you're not using it. But the whole concept of the Indian water rights is that those water rights were reserved for the tribe by the original treaties. You know, in your state, actually, with the Chickasaw and Cherokee and Creek and Seminole and Choctaw, when they were moved to Oklahoma forcibly by the federal government in the 1830s, they were promised no state would ever be created there. So it was an unusual kind of promise. I don't think there were other treaties that were like that, or at least none come to mind. But the concept is that those treaties reserve sufficient waters so that the tribes could, even in the 21st century, come in and take waters that had been appropriated for other uses by non-Indians and put them to use so that the tribes can have a self-sufficient economy. That is been seen by the courts as a promise of the treaties.
We should mention that you're representing some of those tribes as well.
Well, my law firm is.
Yeah, your law firm is.
So,
yeah.
I guess you have to
have to
take
a disclaimer
what I'm
there.
Saying with that. But I'm talking more generally about tribes right. In other states, too.
My guest today is Reed Chambers. He was a former associate solicitor in the U.S. Department of Interior during the Nixon administration when the way the federal government dealt with tribes changed completely, and there will be a forum at Gilcrease Museum on Wednesday talking about these changes in how the federal government relates to Native American tribes. That's this Wednesday at Gilcrease. He'll be one of the featured speakers along with Brad Patterson, a former executive assistant at the Nixon White House, Kent Frizzell, who was the solicitor and then undersecretary of the Department of Interior, Wallace Johnson, a former assistant attorney general, and a number of other scholars who were there during this change of policy. We've kind of talked a little bit about the impact of this change, but certainly where you see tribal governments building schools, building roads, creating industries, some that are contentious like casinos, as well as other industries that are, you know, manufacturing, energy production, and the like. This decision has utterly transformed how tribes operate in this country. Would you agree?
Oh, I do agree, Rich. And the other aspect of the policy that we haven't talked about, in addition to enforcing the legal rights in court, was a change in the way federal Indian programs were administered. That President Nixon proposed that the federal government, the Indian Health Service and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, that the programs that they administer serving Indians, for what you're talking about, for Indian education, for example, or housing programs, or health services, that those programs, instead of being administered again by the federal bureaucracy, should be contracted so that the Indian tribes administered them, the way many states and local governments ultimately provide federal services to their populations. So there was a contracting program embodied in what ultimately became the Indian Self-Determination Act, which President Nixon proposed. Congress didn't enact it until 1975, so it was signed by President Ford. But under that set of statute, there've been some amendments to it, so I'm talking about a set of this. There's now a self-governance statute in addition to the Self-Determination Act. But under the basic today, for example, over half of the money that goes to the Indian Health Service that's appropriated to them by Congress, over half of that is contracted to Indian tribes and tribal organizations to run health clinics, to run hospitals, if you know, on some reservations, or in Alaska, regional hospitals serving, providing health services to Indians. Not quite half of the BIA program monies are contracted to tribes, but millions of dollars are administered by tribes under federal programs, subject, of course, to tight audit requirements. So the tribes really provide most of the basic federal services to Indians on their reservations. And Nixon's message talked about in 1970, when it was put forth, that only, I think, something like 1% of the BIA budget and about 2% of the Indian Health Service budget were actually contracted to tribes under some old statutes, the Bi-Indian Act. Now about half of the federal programs in those two agencies are half of the monies are run by tribes, and that's a big, big change.
Let me ask you, I tend to look at results. Has the outcomes from these changes been overall positive? If, for example, Indian health, is Indian health better today than it was 30, 40 years ago? Educational opportunities, better? I would think by most measures, the answer would be yes, but has that been the case?
Yes, it's better, but not good enough. I mean, first of all, just as a matter of, I guess, political dynamics or political philosophy, it's always an improvement, almost always an improvement, for a group to be self-governing as opposed to being governed by someone else. Just in terms of the group then becomes responsible for its own activities, it becomes accountable to its own members. Almost all tribes are popularly elected, their governments, and if the governments aren't serving the people the way the people want to be served, the leaders are accountable. That's not true if you're dealing with a federal bureaucracy that's administering programs for you. So all of the economic results now in the last couple of decades have been marked improvement for Indian people. But it's not good enough. I mean, economically, I don't know the statistics for Oklahoma, but economically nationwide, Indians living on reservations have about 60% of the per capita income as the average American.
There are health disparities.
There certainly are disparities. There tend to be sometimes different health problems on reservations. Diabetes is a bigger problem in Indian country, and some of that is just simply genetic. Just to give one example. But the difference between the disparity between Indian communities and non-Indian communities is reducing. So that part is good, but much more needs to be done, and so it's not by any means a finished task.
I will imagine we'll hear a bit of that as well at this forum on Wednesday at Gilchrist Museum. Reed Chambers, thanks very much for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you very much. I certainly enjoyed it.
Reed Chambers is a former Associate Solicitor for Indian Affairs at the U.S. Department of Interior during the Nixon and Ford administration. He'll be the moderator for the two discussions as a part of the Conference on Native American Self-Determination at Gilchrist Museum this Wednesday. The event is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.